Welcome back to another edition of the ASEP Equal Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Dr. Jason Woods. Today's discussion is with Dr. Jonathan Edlow, who's a professor of emergency medicine at the Harvard School of Medicine and the vice chair of emergency medicine at Beth Israel Deaconess Hospital in Boston. His primary focus is the reduction of misdiagnoses for commonly presenting neurologic emergencies in the emergency department. Today, we are talking specifically about non-traumatic back pain as a presenting symptom.
So we're going to start talking about back pain. Just to set the stage, we're not talking about traumatic back pain here. That's a whole different kettle of fish, and that's not what we're talking about. We're going to talk about trying to reduce the misdiagnosis rate of some of the more serious causes. We're going to talk about some of the red flags, which is all history and physical exam. The red flags we'll get into some detail about. There's actually a lot less data about that than I would like, but that's the status of it. And then talk about some sort of algorithmic strategies to reduce unnecessary imaging and talk about why that imaging is, in fact, unnecessary. This is in that paper. This is the way I think about low back pain. The reality is that the vast majority of our patients, I would estimate around 90%, most of our patients fall into that green zone of low risk. Very small percentage, maybe 2 or 3, fall into that red zone of high risk. And then there's about 5 or 6, 7% that is sort of in between an intermediate risk, and we'll talk about each of these in more detail. Before I start talking about some of the spinal and caudequina and cord type things, we need to remember, and all of us that practice clinical medicine know, that there are a lot of systemic diseases and things in the belly, things in the retroperitoneum that can present with back pain. We're also not going to be talking about those, but the reality is when you're doing a clinical shift, you're going to need to think about some of these other diagnoses, renal issues, pancreatic issues, aortic issues, sometimes biliary tract issues that can and do present as back pain. So you all remember the old spinal cord and the Frank-Netter diagram. And what we're really talking about, there are dozens of rare causes, but there's sort of 4 things that you need to bear in mind in terms of serious causes. And those are tumor, central disc herniations that can cause a caudequina syndrome, epidural hematoma, and epidural abscess. And it comes down to really the test that we're talking about is an MRI. You know, do they need it? If they do, do they need it right now? And if they need it, how do you protocolize it? What part of the spine do you image? Do you use gadolinium or not? Let's just talk about the high risk for a second, because part of choosing wisely is knowing when you do need to get an imaging study. And this is, again, history and physical exam. It's asking these questions to try to get at the red flags that are going to suggest the diagnosis or make more likely the diagnosis a central disc or a tumor or an abscess or a hematoma. And then doing a fairly careful physical examination with regard to low back pain of lower extremities and a neurological exam of the lower extremities. So these red flags, the evidence is weak. There are no well-done studies, certainly no well-done studies in emergency department populations. And even the primary care data from which a lot of what I'm going to talk about comes is not great. The best validated ones are a history of cancer, corticosteroid use, and this is more for vertebral compression fractures than it is for those other 4 diagnoses we're talking about, and anticoagulant use. The one physical finding, and to some extent it's history too, there's a couple of articles that have found that even in the absence of physical findings of actual weakness when you test the muscle groups, and in the absence of any clear-cut sentry deficit, the patient's inability to walk properly or new frequent falls, new ataxia, that in and of itself is actually a risk factor. Remember that the history finding, so somebody that, say, has a history of cancer, a history finding like that will suggest the possibility of neurologic issues, whereas a hard physical finding, if that person has a sensory level or if that person has a lax sphincter tone, that suggests the probability of a real, actual neurological problem. And another thing that hasn't been really talked about or studied, I should say, is the fact that groups of these red flags probably perform better than individual red flags, but there's simply no data about that.
And that's actually a concept that has come up very frequently as we've been discussing all of these equal things, is that groupings of findings or constellations are nearly always more helpful than singular findings.
So for epidural tumor, the history of a systemic cancer, it's weight loss. For abscess, it's fever, it's some type of immunocompromised state, including diabetes, IV drug use, a history of a recent bacteremia or a history of a recent urinary tract infection. And for hematoma, it's that ever-growing portion of our population that is on various anticoagulants or recent manipulation, including spinal anesthesia or injection. I talked about the new frequent falls, the new difficulty walking. The duration of 3 weeks is admittedly somewhat arbitrary. The vast majority of patients with sciatica will get better and be asymptomatic within 4 to 6 weeks. So if someone's getting better over the course of 3 weeks, but they still have pain, that wouldn't automatically make me get an MRI on them. But if it's getting worse over a 3 week course of time, you need to think about that. Obviously, pain that wakes a patient up from sleep suggests the possibility of a cord or a spinal canal problem, sphincter symptoms. Lermite sign is something that I don't see very often, but if you see it, you should take it seriously, which is when the patient flexes their neck and there's like an electrical shock-like sensation that goes down their back and into their extremities. This has been described with multiple sclerosis, but also with some type of lesion that kind of tethers or fixes the cord or nerve root. And then the other thing is bilateral leg symptoms. I don't think we think about that as much. If you have a central disc herniation, or if you have an abscess or a tumor that happens to be pushing posteriorly, then you're going to get bilateral symptoms and a caudequina syndrome. So when I have a patient with back pain and bilateral buttock or bilateral leg radiation, it gets my antenna wiggling a little bit. Again, it's a history flag. It doesn't mean that it's definitely something central, but it's a little bit unusual for plain old sciatica. The physical exam, you need to test the muscle groups. You need to look for a sensory level. You should have these patients walk at some point. I realize some patients have so much pain when they come and they can't, but before they leave, you should make sure they can walk. You want to look at their knee jerks and their ankle jerks and test Babinski. We'll talk about Babinski in a minute and why that can be important. If you have the ability to non-invasively measure a post-void residual with ultrasound or a bladder scan, that can be a useful thing. I do not do a rectal exam in all my patients with back pain, but I do test saddle anesthesia in all of them. You can do that pretty easily, even if they have their underwear or pants on, by just feeling for a sensation perianally or in the high upper medial thighs, medial buttocks, to see if the sensation is symmetrical. In intermediate and high-risk patients, I usually will do a rectal exam to test for sphincter tone, and I'll do a post-void residual, again, now that it's become so easy with an ultrasound or bladder scan.
So let's just recap here, because you said some really amazing things there, and I just want to hammer on the point that most of the red flags that you're listing are history red flags, and even the physical exam ones are typically ones where you decided which part of the physical exam to do based on the history. And this comes up over and over again as we've been doing these podcasts, that if you're taking that detailed history and you know the patterns that you're looking for, abnormal or more rare combinations of symptoms make you sit up and pay attention. So you highlighted a couple of things in there.
Now, there will be patients that have a dangerous diagnosis and don't have a red flag. So you might have a caudequina syndrome patient without sphincter symptoms. Or they might have saddle anesthesia, but without any foot or lower leg problems. In vertebral metastases, about 20% of them, that is the presentation of the cancer. So obviously, in that case, you're not going to have a history of cancer. With abscess, the textbooks always talk about these classic triads, and these were classic triads from 100 years ago when we didn't have any treatments, and it probably didn't make much difference. But the classic triad for epidural abscess of fever and back pain and neurologic deficit is present around 10% of the time, and a third of patients won't have a fever. And with hematoma, about 30% will have no identifiable reason for bleeding. And the reality is that these patients are very tough to make a correct diagnosis on their first visit, and that's why instructions, you know, clear-cut discharge instructions, arranging for follow-up with the primary care doctor is so important, because otherwise you're just going to miss these patients unless you work up everybody for everything, which is obviously not very elegant, not very cost effective, and it's not what we do. So I want to talk just for a moment about the high risk patients, because in choosing wisely, you need to use your imaging in a good way. So these are people that have a new, hard, definite physical finding. And when they've got that, they need an MRI, and they need the MRI emergently. A lot of these patients will have difficulty lying down, and some of these scans will take an hour if you're doing a pan scan with and without gadolinium. So you need to make sure that you've adequately analgesed them, you've adequately treated their anxiety, and you want to decide either by yourself or with the radiologist or with the neurologist what part of the spine to image. This is part of where the Babinski can help, and I do a Babinski on every back pain patient, which means taking off the shoes on every back pain patient. We had a case here at BI probably 6 years ago now where a patient had back pain. They were at a funeral. They were lifting up. They were a pallbearer. They were lifting up the casket. They felt the abrupt onset of pain. They had an MRI done at an outside hospital on day 3, and it was a lumbosacral spine MRI, and it was negative, and came to us on day 6. They had upgoing toes, and the rationale was that because the MRI was negative, it wasn't a problem, and he was admitted for pain control. And I'll tell you the rest of that story in a little bit.
Dr. Edlow creating some suspense there.
But the Babinski means that this is an upper motor neuron lesion, and therefore your lumbosacral spine is not going to image whatever that lesion is. Turned out this guy had a T8 disc and needed to go to the OR. But the Babinski can help you there in terms of leveling. And then finally, you need to speak to the radiologist. If you're really worried about something who's getting rapidly worse with findings that are evolving over hours, you might want to talk to the radiologist or the tech, depending on what kind of hospital you're at, and see if you can move that patient up in the queue. I work at Beth Israel, but I also work at a very small community hospital that's in our network. And a lot of times I can get things done faster at the community hospital because the lines of communication are cleaner than I can at Beth Israel. Remember that the cord ends at L1. That's why it's safe to do a spinal tap where we do the spinal tap, because you're just going through the cauda equina area where the nerve roots are floating in the spinal fluid. And it's important to remember that typical disc disease just picks off a single unilateral root. We talked about this concept of a central disc herniation versus a posterolateral disc herniation. And remember, if you, a la that patient who was the pallbearer at his friend's funeral, if you have a patient who has a lumbosacral spine, you're only getting the cauda equina. There is no spinal cord there. And if you write down rule out cord compression and you get a lumbosacral spine MRI, the radiologist is going to think that you don't know your neuroanatomy, and that's where that Babinski can help. So ordering a lumbosacral spine MRI, I always tell the residents, is like getting a chest CTA to rule out appendicitis. It's not going to rule out cord compression. Remember that cauda equina syndrome, because there are multiple nerve roots that are floating through that sac, you might pick off one or two, you might pick off some incompletely, and you need to be careful about not missing cauda equina, because it doesn't always present in the full-blown form like in the textbook.
And just a reminder that the last 10 minutes of our discussion was specifically for those high-risk patients that have a new concerning physical finding.
All right, so let's come back over to what 90% of our patients are, which is these low-risk patients. I will caution you to say that the large majority of the literature that I'm about to discuss comes from primary care data. It's kind of surprising because back pain is such a common problem. There's not a huge amount of well-known emergency medicine literature about this. But these are patients without red flags. They may have a lot of pain, but they don't need anything other than a history and a physical exam. They don't need routine lab testing, they don't need imaging, they don't need consults, non-steroidals as a basis of your treatment. You want to have them have a short period of time of rest and rapidly get back to normal activity. And you want to explain what's going on. Patient, an explanation to the patient of what you're doing and why you're doing it, as we'll see in the next couple slides, is really key. And make sure that they have decent follow-up. So what are the data to support this recommendation of not getting any imaging? Again, it's mostly from primary care stuff, but it falls into sort of four baskets. The first is the misconception that the patient is just coming for an MRI. And I know, I practice clinically, and some patients will come in and say, I want an MRI. But that's not what most people are looking for. There's a lot of background noise if you do get MRIs. There is some randomized trial data from primary care literature, and there's kind of side effects, and I use that in quotes, as you'll see in a moment, to getting imaging. This is one of my favorite studies. It comes from years and years ago. It's called the North Carolina Back Pain Project. And what it was not a randomized trial, but it was a large study of about 1,600 patients. It was from different practices in North Carolina. And some of them were primary care doctors in practice. Some of them were in HMOs. Some of the doctors were orthopedists, and some of the caregivers were chiropractors. They enrolled patients with low back pain, and they looked at their six-month outcomes, and they looked at patient satisfaction. And the orthopedists and chiropractors spent more money than the primary care doctors, who spent more money than the HMO primary care doctors. The amount of imaging performed showed the same pattern. But when they looked at the outcomes, basically they were identical. And then they looked at patient satisfaction. And the satisfaction was higher with the chiropractors than with any of the groups of physicians. But they looked at the three specific things that were associated with increased patient satisfaction. And the first thing was the patient's perception that a detailed history was taken. And the reality is that a patient doesn't really know what an appropriate history is and what isn't. I suspect asking them about urination and about their feet to a lot of people with back pain seems a little bit left field. It also tracked patient satisfaction. It is tracked with their perception that a complete physical exam was done, and their perception that the physician explained what they were thinking. And the reason I love this study is because it really, I think, has to do with most of our patients. If you just spend a little bit of quality time, and it might be 90 seconds or 120 seconds or 3 minutes of quality time, and explain why you're thinking what you're thinking, that's what most patients are looking for, even the ones that come in and say, I want an MRI. What was not important when they looked at it and tried to tease it out was imaging tests.
And I think that runs counter to something that we hear discussed a lot, that patients are only coming in for imaging or pain medications or some sort of definitive testing, when really many of them, as long as you spend some time with them and tell them what you're thinking, will be satisfied with that visit.
What about background noise? What if you do a bunch of MRIs on normal people? What do you find? Well, this was a study that was done on 100 asymptomatic patients with zero back pain. These are people walking down the street, no problem. And they mixed a bunch of patients with back pain in too. And they showed these MRIs to two different neuroradiologists. Only a third, 36%, only a third of the MRIs were read as completely normal. About half of them had bulges. And when you read these MRI reports that you get back, you see this on most of them. A little bulge here, a little bulge there, a little focal disc here. Half of them had non-focal disc bulges. A quarter of them had focal disc protrusions. 1%, these are normal, healthy, no back pain patients, had a frankly herniated disc. And then there's other findings that you see scattered around them. And the problem is that when you get these MRIs, it has some downstream complications. And we'll talk about this with this. This was a randomized trial. These were patients that were in a primary care practice. The primary care doctor decided they wanted to get a lumbar spine film. And in this study, they randomized those patients to plain film versus MRI and looked at their outcomes at 12 months. And obviously the costs were lower with plain films. The ED length of stay is going to increase with MRI just to get it and to get the interpretation. In this primary care study, there was absolutely no difference in the outcome of these patients. So MRI doesn't really help the large majority of patients. And I think that the patients in that green zone of my algorithm are pretty similar to patients in a primary care clinic. We clearly have an acuity skewed patient overall, but the low risk ones, I think, are similar to the patients that were in this study. And what happens is they end up getting consults, they end up getting epidural steroid injections, and they end up getting more spine surgery, much of which I think is unnecessary. So there are side effects of doing an MRI. $10,000 might not seem like a huge amount of money in terms of healthcare expenditures, but you multiply that times the many, many millions of patients with back pain, and it adds up.
And I know this is going to be a little bit of unabashed self-promotion here, but those side effects are exactly why Choosing Wisely exists. And you can go back and listen to a couple of our other podcasts through the ASAP Equal series that are specifically about avoiding unnecessary imaging.
There are some patients that fall into intermediate zone, and sometimes you need to shift over to the green, and sometimes you need to shift over to the red. There are times when, for example, they have a history red flag, or they're HIV positive, but they're on treatment, and they have a low viral load and a normal CD4, and they have pain after exercise, or someone has a UTI or sinusitis and they happen to have some back pain with a fever, or, and this happens, this is an important one, someone urinates on themselves not because they didn't have control or couldn't feel a full bladder, but because of the back pain, they couldn't get to the bathroom on time. So teasing out someone that has so much back pain they can't get to the bathroom on time versus someone that can't feel the need to urinate or can't control is an important thing, important distinction to make. Some people may have constipation due to the opioids that they're taking and not due to a neurological problem. And not everybody taking an anticoagulant, which is a history red flag, needs to be MRI. So with that intermediate group, you'll sometimes have a patient where they do need to be MRI'd right away. Their physical exam is normal, but they have a lot of history red flags. And this was a real case that we had, basically a patient with fever, back pain, IV drug use, and a SED rate from the transferring hospital of 80. They had an epidural abscess. Now, ideally, you want to catch these patients before they have a neurologic deficit. And that's why there will be some patients without a hard new neurological finding in whom you are concerned that you decide you're going to get an MRI right away. So again, the intermediate group of patients, you've got some options here. If cancer and abscess are your two main diagnoses, then a CRP and a SED rate are extremely sensitive for those diagnoses. You may get a consultation. You may decide, I'm going to image this patient, or you may decide I'm going to image this patient in a day or two if you're in an environment that allows you to set that up. Whatever you do, if you dispo that patient, if you discharge them, you should make sure that the patient and the family understand what the plan is and that the PCP knows that this patient is coming their way. Just a word about CRP and SED rate. There's been no high-quality prospective study in any population, really. There are pretty good data, though, that if you look at studies of patients with a specific diagnosis, such as epidural abscess or metastatic disease, the SED rate is very sensitive. There's not a lot of great data to say that the SED rate's better than the CRP or vice versa. I've seen cases where one is positive and the other isn't, and vice versa. SED rate tends to go up sooner because it's got a shorter half-life, tends to be a earlier acute phase reactant than the SED rate. But I think that in some patients, if you're in a place where you've got a history red flag, someone says they're a shooter, but they haven't shut up in 3 months and they've got some back pain, you know, if their SED rate or their CRP is completely normal, it really makes abscess much, much less likely. I always get a little nervous if I have a patient with thoracic cord symptoms, or thoracic back pain, I should say. Lumbar back pain is extremely common. Neck pain is very common, but thoracic pain is less common, and discs are much more rare in that area, and there's less wiggle room in the cord because the epidural space is smaller, and tumor is more common there. So I always factor that in some soft way about decisions about imaging. Remember, too, that some patients will have symptoms that gradually get worse over time, and some patients will develop symptoms all of a sudden. And by that, I mean neurological symptoms. So someone might have back pain for 3 weeks and then gradually develop weakness or sensory symptoms. And another patient might have back pain for 3 weeks and then from one moment to the next, they become paralyzed. So the paradigm for that is like a gradually increasing metastatic lesion in a vertebral body that gradually impinges more and more on the cord or the cauda quina, you know, versus a pathological fracture. So they have pain from the tumor in the bone, and then the moment of that fracture, you get a piece of bone that goes into the cord or the cauda quina, and you have an instant problem neurologically. That can also happen if a tumor sort of pinches off the anterior spinal artery, or for an epidural abscess, if it does the same thing, or if it creates a septic arteritis or phlebitis, you can get a cord infarction. So remember that the pace of illness and the natural history is not always a logical, orderly, linear one. So again, you should think about back pain, atraumatic back pain, in these three overall buckets. Green bucket is no red flags. On the red high-risk side, these are patients with new, hard, definite physical findings. They need a quick MRI. And then the patients in the intermediate, think about getting a consult. Think about getting imaging, thinking about using your inflammatory markers to better risk stratify those patients.
I did want to ask, and I think we already know your answer to this, but is there any utility for plain films of the back in non-traumatic back pain?
Not really. It's very seductive because you can sort of, even with cancer, for example, I mean, some cancers like prostate cancer or lung cancer, the vast majority of those will show changes on the plain films, but some of them don't. So it's a slippery slope, and it's kind of like the psychology of misdiagnosis, where you begin to stuff the data into your preconceived hypothesis, and having a negative plain film just doesn't rule out any of those four major causes of bad causes of back pain that we talked about at the very beginning, a central disc, hematoma, abscess, or tumor. So if it's positive, that's great. You need to go on and get an MRI. But if it's negative and you're still worried, you need to get an MRI. And if you're not that worried, you shouldn't have gotten any imaging in the first place. It's kind of a seductive psychological slippery slope, but I don't think there's any role for it.
Thank you, Dr. Edlow, for being here. A lot of our other discussions on imaging have really centered around not ordering tests whenever they're not needed, and this took a little bit of a different approach as far as not wanting to miss the high-risk diagnoses and working from there to figure out who needs imaging and who doesn't. Special thanks go out to David Yang for editing help on this episode. And all those listeners out there, thank you so much for giving us your time today. You can find the rest of our ASEP Equal series through the Academic Life in Emergency Medicine feed through Apple Podcasts. You can read our associated blog posts at www.aliem.com. You can find me on Twitter at jwoodsmd or via email at littlepatientsbigmedicine@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening.